You are now going to listen to KAZI Book Review with Hopeton Hay.
In Simon Baltel's book, Occupy Territory, he examines the history of the Chicago Police Department's contentious relationship with the black community. He writes that over the course of the mid-20th century, black neighborhoods were increasingly over-patrolled, underprotected, and faced harassment, violence, and neglect from the Chicago Police Department. In particular, he points to the racially biased use of selective enforcement by the department in the 1960s as a major tipping point. Simon Baltel is an assistant professor of African American history at the University of Iowa. Simon Baltel, welcome to KAZI Book Review.
Thank you so much for having me.
So Simon, as I understand it, you actually grew up in the rural Midwest, but it was when you moved to Chicago in your early 20s that you really started to notice the difference in policing of different communities based on class.
Class and race. I was born in Milwaukee, but my adoptive parents lived in really rural Wisconsin, where pretty much everyone except for myself and a few other folks were very, very white. And so it was such a small, set of communities that were so geographically dispersed that we didn't really even have much in the way of a active police force that was a part of the community. There was a sheriff's department, but the sheriff's office was over a half hour drive away. And so, I didn't have much in the way of engagement with law enforcement or really even any thoughts or observances about it when I was a kid. But then when I moved to Chicago in my early 20s, I was living in, on the north side, the far north side, Rogers Park, which is, one of the most diverse communities in the city. But that's sort of an anomaly in Chicago because it's such a segregated city. And so when I would go about the city, if you go to North Lawndale, or if you go to the Loop, or if you go to Wrigleyville, or if you go to Hyde Park, these are all neighborhoods that have just really fundamentally different rhythms to them. And part of the different rhythms to them is just the ways in which the police operate in completely different ways and seem to have completely different attitudes towards the people that they're engaged with and seem to actually perform a completely different function from one neighborhood to the next.
And you quote a historian, Sam Matrani, who said that leading businessmen who dominated both urban economies and their politics pushed city government to build powerful armed institutions that could defend their property and their interests from the new threats that accompanied the development of a wage labor economy. So the police departments were founded in the major cities between the 1840s and the 1880s, and they were really founded not primarily to protect all citizens, but to protect the economic interests of the privileged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's, this is something that I think a lot of people don't really appreciate about the origins of big city police is that, most of them are, Chicago especially is a great case in point in the sense that the police function is one that is originated by rich people to effectively control poor people in the working class. The story of a city like Chicago in the middle of the 19th century is that it's a city of immigrants, and that maintains as truth into the 20th century. But what is happening in the mid 19th century is that you have a lot of immigrants, people who, people that we would in today's parlance usually think of as just white. But at the time, these are immigrants coming from, Ireland, Poland, Italy, all sorts of different countries that are somewhat alarming. Chicago actually has a giant German population. These are all people that are coming in and, many of them don't speak English. Many of them are not all that interested in just absorbing themselves into the, into the fabric of a city like Chicago in the sense of, you know, abandoning traditional languages, abandoning traditional customs, and so on and so forth. And so the origins of the Chicago Police Department is essentially that business owners and privileged elites in the city initiate the founding of a police force to try to do things like surveil and contain immigrant behavior, especially things like drinking, that they're very opposed to public displays of, you know, of drunkenness and public celebrations in the ways that a lot of, you know, for example, German immigrants were accustomed to doing. And then the other side to that is that they're also very interested and very invested in trying to contain the labor radicalism of a lot of these people. You know, I mean, that they're, a lot of the folks that are immigrating to Chicago are going to work in various industries. And, you know, as the 1800s move forward, part of the story of America, part of the story of Chicago is that a lot of these working class people are trying to fight to gain better wages, better working conditions, and so on. And so part of what business owners and privileged elites in a city like Chicago are trying to do is also to curb and contain the labor militancy that this new working class is trying to develop in order to gain their rights as workers.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KAZI Book Review on KAZI 88.7 FM. I'm Hope Ten Hay. My guest is Simon Balto. He is the author of Occupy Territory, Policing Black Chicago from Red Summer to Black Power. Now, one of the reasons I really wanted to read your book when I was reading the summary of it, you described the police as black communities as being over-patrolled and under-protected and facing harassment, violence, and neglect from the police department that their taxes helped fund. So fundamentally, you're pointing to the fact that we're paying their salaries. The community is helping to pay their salaries. And there's this aggressive patrolling, especially in the black community, but really under protection of the community. And I recall running across discussions of that issue with a professor named Rashad Shabazz. He's the author of Spatialized in Blackness. And so we had this discussion about whether or not there's over-policing, which was the term that he used and which was the term I used to talk to a local community leader. And so, but reading through your history, we see that there was informal over-policing that actually became formal over-policing under a criminologist who became superintendent of the Chicago Police Department in 1960, a gentleman named Orlando Wilson. So talk a little bit about how Orlando Wilson, who had all these ideas on professionalizing and modernizing the police force, but at the same time implemented policies that enhance racial oppression of blacks.
That's a great question. Yeah, I mean, the fundamental principle that animates a lot of my book is that, you know, when we're looking at the development of this system that I think, I shouldn't say everyone understands, but at least a lot of black folks understand, you know, when we're looking at a police force that has a really outsized presence and a really aggressive presence in a lot of black communities, which is, you know, over patrolling or over policing, however you want to term it. You know, the flip side to that equation is that a lot of those communities, a lot of those neighborhoods, a lot of those blocks remain unsafe for a lot of people. And so the question is, what is the purpose of all of that over policing since it doesn't seem to be effective anyway? And so part of what I'm tracing in my book, you know, I start at the end of the 19 teens and then take it forward through the 1970s is I try to take a look to your great question as to how those dueling realities of over-policing and under-protection that started really in a kind of informalized way when applied to the black community, how those became more formalized. And so you're correct to point to the 1960s as one really, really crucial, perhaps the most pivotal moment in that history. And so what happens is that in at the very beginning of 1960, the Chicago Police Department is facing a real crisis of legitimacy for not just Chicago's black community, but for the entire city. You know, the Chicago Police Department is a department that's notoriously corrupt for the vast majority of its history. And, you know, it had been kind of a running joke, you know, in some quarters as to just how corrupt the police department was. But that at the very end of the 1950s, this scandal erupts in which there's this string of really, really over-the-top burglaries that happen in a white neighborhood on the north side. And it comes out in the newspapers that part of the reason why this burglar had been so successful is because he's working in cohort with a bunch of cops on the north side. And so when the scandal breaks, basically it forces the mayor, Richard Daley, to at least offer the veneer of some change at the top of the police department. And so what happens as a result of this is that they hire this really renowned criminologist named Orlando Wilson, who is the dean of criminology at University of California, Berkeley. They give him a fat salary to move from the Bay Area to Chicago to take over the police department and to reform it. And so he has a lot of important, he's, I think, probably the most consequential police superintendent in the city's history. I think he's probably one of the most influential police thinkers and criminologists in the history of the American 20th century. And one of the things that he's really concerned with is doing things like professionalizing the police department in the sense of trying to root out some of this corruption, trying to make police officers more accountable when they do things that are wrong. And that includes everything from taking bribes or shaking down citizens to committing acts of brutality and torture, which were commonplace and still are commonplace with the Chicago Police Department. So he undertakes those types of things and does so with very uneven success, not because he's not actually invested in doing those things. He actually wants to get rid of bad cops in the sense of cops who are overly abusive and brutal. But the reason he's not really successful in doing some of those things is because he faces an incredible amount of resistance from inside his own police department, and particularly from organizations like the Fraternal Order of Police, you know, and other organizations that will eventually unionize. But the other side to his philosophy is that although he wants to make police more accountable, he also has no interest in looking at incidents of things that he would term to be criminal or disorderly. He doesn't want to look at those things and think that there's any approach to solving them other than to utilize the police in more forceful ways. So he also, and one way to think about this, I guess, is that in addition to wanting to make the police more accountable for their behavior, he also wants to make citizens more accountable. And so he does things, for example, like lobbying the state legislature to formalize the police power to stop and frisk. You know, this is before stop and frisk has been granted legal cover by the United States Supreme Court. So he's trying to get it enacted at the local and state level. He is implementing policies that explicitly make quotas for arrests for police officers. This is something that police departments routinely have denied exist. But if there's absolutely clear evidence from police records that they exist, so he does things like quotas, and I think one of the most consequential things that he does is he implements this new policy that is a policy of selective enforcement, and that's the word that the police constantly use, which is selective enforcement. Essentially, means that you in certain neighborhoods you can look the other way at certain misbehaviors. What happens is that that selective enforcement is not applied equally across the city. And so, you know, somebody who is jaywalking in, you know, the Gold Coast, which is a near North Side wealthy neighborhood, is not going to be stopped by the police. But somebody who's jaywalking in perhaps North Lawndale is going to be stopped by the police, North Lawndale being, by that point in time, an increasingly black neighborhood.
Well, the black community was really socially marginalized, and you say they had little access to the instruments of reform. But talk a bit about the black community's efforts to fight back of this racially repressive policy of the police department under Orlando Wilson.
Basically, throughout the first half of the 1960s, there's a lot of civil rights activism in Chicago. And the main effort at that point in time when it comes to the police is really about trying to make the police more accountable through things like getting, you know, a citizen review board and things like that. It was kind of tinkering with the system rather than challenging it forthrightly. And so by the end of the decade, though, this is when, you know, Orlando Wilson has left, but the policies that he had put in place during that time were really being felt acutely by black citizens. By the end of the 60s, you get the rise of the Panthers in Chicago, and you get more assertive challenges to the legitimacy of the police and the legitimacy of what they're trying to do. And then by the, you know, by the beginning of the 1970s, what you have is a interracial and citywide movement to try to gain community control of the police. So to really democratize the police and make it essentially a neighborhood level institution rather than a citywide institution, because community members in places like North Lawndale or in places like Englewood are recognizing the fact that a police force that is administered from downtown, you know, from the halls of power essentially attached to City Hall, is not necessarily concerned with the concerns of those communities. And so you get a range of challenges to the ways in which the police are operating that, you know, during the 1960s can range from, you know, from sort of tinkering with the system and trying to make it a little bit more functional, a little more accountable, to by the end of the 1960s and the early 1970s, actually challenging the entire arrangement of policing and the entire logic of policing as it operates on the ground.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KAZI Book Review on KAZI 88.7 FM. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Simon Balto. We're talking about his new book, Occupied Territory, Policing Black Chicago from Red Summer to Black Power. Now, you talk in the book about the rise of Black Power politics and urban rebellion, and you specifically share the tragic story of the assassination of Black Panther leader Fred Hampton and, I believe, Mark Clark in 1969. Talk a bit about how the rise of Black Power in those urban rebellions resulted in blowback from the police department.
It's a great question. I mean, the, you know, the one of the things, one of the realities about the police in the 1960s, particularly in the second half of the 1960s, is that they're feeling increasingly paranoid and increasingly self-defensive because of things like the anti-war movement and, you know, all the various clashes that go on between law enforcement and, you know, anti-war demonstrators and protesters, you know, whether that be in Chicago, whether that be in Kent State and so on and so forth. But the urban rebellions of the 1960s, and especially the rise of Black Power organizations like the Panthers, which are formed really in explicit opposition to and rejection of the police, really set the police's teeth on edge in an important and really pretty terrible way. You know, that the ways in which the police are talking about the you know, the Panthers and other organizations by the end of the 1960s, they're really talking about these citizens as though they are at war. You know, and so we have famous invocations by people like J. Edgar Hoover, head of the FBI, who talks about the Black Panther Party as being the greatest domestic threat to the United States, the national security of the United States. But at the local level, you also have the same sorts of things being said by police officers, police officials, and politicians. And so, you know, the culminating point for this in Chicago is, you know, throughout 1969, which is when the Black Panther Party really was briefly in its heyday in Chicago, is an incredibly important and influential and successful organization in Chicago for that brief moment in time under the leadership of Fred Hampton. Throughout 1969, you have the Chicago Police Department just waging war against the Panthers. I mean, raiding their offices, assaulting members on the streets. By November, this is essentially erupting into open armed conflict between some, you know, between at least one Panther member and police officers down on the South Side. And so on December 4th of 69, so 50 years ago this year, you know, the police, in coordination with the FBI and in coordination with the Cook County State's Attorney's Office, they conspire to drug Fred Hampton and then execute him in his sleep. I mean, there's really no other way to say it other than that the police raided his apartment, you know, carrying machine guns, and shot nearly 100 bullets into his apartment and executed Fred Hampton in his bed and killed Mark Clark in the process and injured four other Panthers who were also in the apartment in the process. I mean, so this is a really, it's very much an effort.
Well, let me throw in with the fact rule here.
Yeah.
How many bullets were fired by the Panthers? One?
One bullet exactly was fired by the Panthers, and it's speculated that that was actually fired by Mark Clark in defense as he was shot.
So this was an execution.
It was, there's no question about it.
Was it an execution?
Yeah, I mean, and this was litigated for over a decade, and finally the city of Chicago settled out of court with Fred Hampton's family for between $1.5 and $2 million. But yeah, you know, there was no, I mean, all of the evidence, you know, toxicology reports show that Hampton had been drugged. One of the Secretary of Defense for the Illinois Panthers was an FBI informant who drew a map of Fred Hampton's apartment that he supplied to the FBI. He supplied it to the raiding officers. And the speculation is also that he was responsible for drugging Hampton. I mean, because, you know, Fred Hampton was sleeping next to his 8 months pregnant wife at the time. And she recalls that he wouldn't even move. I mean, that there were being bullets fired, and he lifted his head barely and then went back to sleep, which is completely uncharacteristic of him as a person, but also of anybody who's experiencing that sort of violence around them. I mean, so the police, without question, assassinated Fred Hampton.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KAZI Book Review on KAZI 88.7 FM. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Simon Balto. He is the author of Occupy Territory, Policing Black Chicago from Red Summer to Black Power. One of the things you talk about in the book is how they criminalize poverty and the vagrancy laws, picking people up for handing out on corners. This was both a racial and class oppression. And talk a little bit about that, because what we're talking about, if we go back to the 1850s, was the fear of the immigrant labor coming to work the manufacturing and industrial sector in Chicago, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so there was economic privilege, economic interest, feared that, wanted to control that. And then as the Great Migration came, there became the fear of the Black community. And matter of fact, one of the things you talk about in your book was how the goal was to contain vice and crime and push it to some degree into the Black community if it spilled mm-hmm. over into the white community. So it seems, number one, that there was just this fear, and you talked earlier about the working class And B, this isn't police. This is almost like a police state.
A few different things going on here. So to pick up on something that you mentioned in the course of that question, I mean, so when we're thinking about things that people would characterize as quote unquote, you know, undesirable, things like having sex workers on the street, things like, drug havens and so on and so forth. During the early 1900s, there is a very explicit move by the police department to channel those activities into black neighborhoods. And this sounds like a conspiracy theory, but it's not. And police officials at the time were very explicit about this, where they essentially figured out, okay, we're not going to get rid of sex work. We're not going to, they would say prostitution. We're not going to get rid of sex work. We're not going to get rid of drugs. We're not going to get rid of gambling houses during Prohibition. We're not going to get rid of illegal bars, because people are just going to find a way to get those things. But what they do say is, okay, well, if we can't get rid of those things, then at least we can channel them into places where most important people in the city, quote unquote, important people in the city don't care about. So you actually have police officials that just say, we figured out that we could just relocate those things into black districts and then things would be fine. And then in terms of the criminalization of poverty, this is something that happens unevenly and happens in different ways over the course of this time period. But whether that be during the 1930s, the police force being responsible in part for things like during the middle of the Great Depression, evicting black people from their homes, you have the police force operating to essentially punish people for the conditions that society has wrought. And this is a story that probably will sound familiar to those of us who care about our communities even now. But it's important, I think, to understand that this has been a function of the police department for a really long time. And this is part of what led people especially during the 1960s, to in some ways rebel against the police force because of the ways in which they are criminalizing, human misery that is a product of social conditions rather than the fault of individuals themselves.
So you did, you got your PhD, and I believe this Chicago policing was your dissertation, but prior to that, you studied policing in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Talk a little bit about what you learned from studying policing in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, that informed your study of policing in Chicago.
It's a good question. Pardon me. When I started researching Milwaukee, it was for a couple of reasons. I mean, part one, because I was born there. Two, because it was as somebody who was living in Wisconsin, it was a little more accessible to me as I was starting out that was my master's thesis. Really what I learned from studying Milwaukee that informed how I approached studying Chicago was that these histories of hyper-aggressive policing and racially disproportionate and racially unequal policing, that these are things that have a much longer history than people have generally given them credit for. That a lot of the scholarship around hyper-aggressive policing takes 1965 as a pivot point, because that was when the federal government launched the war on crime. But that when I was looking at Milwaukee, I really was focusing on the years right after World War II, specifically kind of 1945 to 1965. And, I found all sorts of evidence of the ways in which the police operated in fundamentally racist ways in black communities in Milwaukee. And so when I pivoted to Chicago, that really informed how I was looking at that history. I mean, that I didn't want to write a history that looked at 1965 and after in the way that a lot of the scholarship on these issues has kind of assumed I should. But instead, I was actually really looking at 1965 as a little bit of an analytic endpoint, and kind of trying to figure out how the police system developed in the years and then decades leading up to 1965.
So let's take a walk back in history. Let's go back to 1919, the
sure.
Red Summer. That's something that's really not that well known within, you know, the community, what happened, the riots of 1919. Now, I have a sense from some of the reading I've done over the years that there was rioting in part because there was resentment of the black American soldiers that came back from World War I, who felt like they fought for the country and were just seeking to be treated equally like men. And many whites were resentful of that. But at the same time, when we look at what happened in Chicago on a beach, and this is very, very specific, what sort of incited the riots in Chicago in July of 1919, four young boys on a raft mistakenly go to the white part of the beach, mistakenly on the raft. A white man starts throwing rocks at them. One of them actually drowns. They go to the black policeman on the beach for help. The white policeman there refuses to allow the white person that caused the death of this young black man, refuses to allow him to be arrested. And the frustration and anger just ultimately boils over, and there's just a series of riots that I believe lasted 4 days. So talk a little bit about that sort of 1919, because apparently there were riots, a lot of riots all over the country.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there were, when we talk about Red Summer, people usually talk about 1919 specifically, but, I think it's important to understand that during this kind of extended period right after World War I, there's actually a lot of racial conflict in places all across the country. I mean, you know, probably the most devastating one of these, quote unquote race riots actually happened in 1921 in Tulsa, where white folks just absolutely, essentially and literally burned black Tulsa to the ground. So it's important to not think of 1919 as a singular event, but rather sort of part of a longer period of essentially white terrorism and black and various black responses. Chicago specifically, you know, this is a moment in time in which Chicago is beginning, you know, Chicago is absorbing, tens of thousands of black folks during this period, during the first Great Migration. And it's in some ways recalibrating the ways in which a lot of white folks in Chicago are thinking about, you know, the demographics of their city, specifically because when a city like Chicago is absorbing that many black folks, they need a place to live. And white Chicagoans generally did not want black people living by them. And so from, you know, beginning in 1917, you get dozens of bombings of black homes and businesses when black people try to move outside of, quote unquote, their territory. So when they try to move into white neighborhoods, you get literal racial terrorism directed their way. So 1919, you know, when the riots erupt in 1919 in Chicago, in which several dozen people, white and black, are killed, white folks killed it basically by blacks operating in self-defense, it's important, I think, to understand that this is not just some sort of blip on the radar that came out of nowhere, but was instead just kind of the watershed moment in a years-long extended process of racial conflict that also continues after the riots. But during the riots themselves, I mean, this is a, this month is the 100th anniversary of these riots in Chicago. And even though this is a moment of incredible importance to the city, almost no one seems to know anything about it. And so I think it's important to understand the history of racial conflict, of racial terrorism, but also to your point about black veterans, you know, the ways in which black folks also responded with armed self-defense in order to try to protect their families and their communities from these sorts of things. You know, that this is an important piece of history that I think is lost to a lot of people.
And let's close by talking about James Baldwin, because the title of your book was inspired in part by an essay he wrote that appeared in the July 11, 1966 issue of The Nation magazine. Mm-hmm. And it's called A Report from Occupied Territory. Now, that essay and the opening of it is, Negroes have always held the lowest jobs, the most menial jobs, which are now being destroyed by automation. No remote provision has yet been made to absorb this labor surplus. Furthermore, the Negro's education, North and South, remains almost totally a segregated education. And this is James Baldwin's final line in this introduction. And the police treat the Negro like a dog. Then he goes to outline this police suppression and this police brutality in New York City. And he grew up in New York City. He grew up in Harlem. Which was just such a grim reminder of what had happened. And the other thing I do want you to also talk about, because when we talk about over-patrolling, one of the things I think about is the disparity between the percentage of African-Americans that use drugs versus the percentage of them that get arrested for possession of drugs. So blacks don't use drugs any more than anybody else, according to the latest data I've read. Yet we have a percentage of being arrested of 3 to 4 times that.
Mm-hmm.
Selective enforcement.
Mm-hmm. It's, sorry, go ahead.
No, that's it.
Oh, okay. I think that when you read Baldwin, you know what I mean? And James Baldwin is probably the intellectual who I most admire, which is probably not a particularly controversial statement. But when you read Baldwin, you know, you can look at that essay, which I think is the clearest example of this. But one of the things that I think is important to think about for people that read Baldwin is that you can look at a lot of his writings from throughout his career and see the way in which a fear of the police works its way into a lot of his work. And that is true of his work, you know, whether that be fiction or nonfiction, whether that be from the 1960s or whether that be from the 1970s or 80s. And the reason I think that's important is I think it's important to understand the ways in which people have been, you know, people, you know, like a child growing up in Harlem is understanding the ways in which the police mistreat them, even at a young age, even back, you know, prior to World War II. You know, that this is, you know, for James Baldwin growing up in Harlem, I mean, you know, when he's writing about being afraid of the police as a kid, you know, he's talking about generations ago at this point. And so, again, to the point about how people tend to think that, you know, these crises of policing and the realities of a racist police system are something new, they're just simply not. And to the point about, you know, over-patrolling, you know, this too is just the ways in which the police have operated for a really long time. You know, in Chicago in the 1950s, you know, we don't have any data on drug use from that period of time. It just was not something that people were necessarily studying in any sort of scientific way. But what we do know is that the Chicago Police Department, even at this point in time when the city is less than 20% black, over 90% of the people that it arrests for drug use are African-American. And it betrays all sorts of logic or all all semblance of reality to assume that that is anything like a proportionate response to the realities of who is using drugs. And the same is true of things like gambling. The same is things of true like public intoxication, and so on and so forth. I mean, that the ways in which the police operate in Black communities has been more aggressive for generations. And I think it's important for people to understand that the things that the Black community is dealing with in 2019 in different ways, but in also ways that have a lot of echoes, were happening in 1969, were happening in 1949, you know, that the, and these are things that have developed over time in ways that uniquely and systematically disadvantage Black folks.
So, Simon, you're a historian. You've really laid out this incredible history of racially repressive policing in the city of Chicago. And I'm going to tell you what my activist friends will all say. And I'm talking, they will say, all right, now we have, you have given us sort of this fundamental understanding that that template could be applied in different cities. But the question everyone's always going to ask is, okay, so what are your ideas on how to reform an institution where racially selective policing, oppressive, has been institutionalized?
How much time do we have?
5 minutes, 6 minutes.
You know, I would answer that as briefly as I can. I would answer that in two parts. The first would be to say that I think that there is a legitimate question as to whether thinking through a lens of quote unquote reform is even especially useful at this point. You know, that a lot of activists would suggest that the lens that we should be actually approaching these things through is not reform but abolition. And that's an entire and enormous political project that requires fundamental reimaginings in a lot of ways of the entire way in which society is structured. If people are interested, I would encourage them to seek out the work of a woman named Maryam Kaba, who is an organizer she's now in New York, but she was in Chicago for a really long time. But she's been on a bunch of podcasts and things like that recently, really laying out in clear terms and succinct ways the reasons why we should pursue an abolitionist agenda to the entire criminal legal system. In the meantime, though, I think that one way that we can think about reform is to actually return to this history, which is to think about and take seriously the project of community control of the police, which is to say that people who live in neighborhoods that have been historically repressed by the police and continue to be repressed by the police, that they should actually have control over what the police operations in their community looks like. The logic behind this, when it, you know, obviously not successfully implemented in Chicago in the early 1970s, but when activists in Chicago in the early 1970s fought for community control of the police, their guiding logic was that, you know, wealthy white men working out of City Hall do not have the slightest clue and don't have an interest in what the concerns of communities who are Black and being marginalized by the police are. So, you know, for example, a neighborhood like Englewood should perhaps be able to have control over its own police force, in which community members would elect essentially a neighborhood-level police board that would administer policy, that would have hiring and firing privileges, that would control police budgets, and so on, because they are the people who know best how the police should be operating because they are actually in that community and have its best interests at heart. So one way, I think, to think about how we would go about doing this, and obviously this, too, is a big political project, but is to bring some sort of democracy to the police, because the reality is that I don't think anybody can at this point really say who the police are responsive to. And so one way that I think we have to fix this system, if it can be fixed as it currently is constituted, is to actually make the police accountable to the people in ways that they just fundamentally are not at this point in time.
Did neighborhood policing not work?
Community policing?
Community policing, yes.
No. It is not. It basically has, to the extent that it works, I mean, it has made, there are some little success stories, but those success stories essentially revolve around the fact that people know the police officers who work in their community better. But that doesn't really change the ways that the system operates. And I think that you could also make a case that community policing, the biggest effect that it had was to, in some ways, desensitize people to the ways in which the police department was operating in repressive ways. That in some ways, familiarizing the community with the police didn't fundamentally alter the system in better ways. It just made the system appear a little bit more friendly than it actually was.
Let me jump back. Earlier in the interview, I talked about, it's in some communities, it's almost like a living in a police state, but it's really more, seems to be more driven by class. So the feeling that you're living in a police state, you know, I grew up in the housing projects of New Orleans, and so you have the over-patrolling going on there. So it's the over-patrolling typically in the lower class or the lower middle class black communities today as opposed to the suburban communities.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly true. And in a lot of ways, that's a product of just the ways in which segregation and urban geography has played out. You know, that when people have the class mobility to move to wealthier suburbs, which are often at least slightly less segregated racially than are the urban centers, although that's not obviously always the case. Class does come into play in important ways in that sense. And that's actually, you know, when we're looking at organizing that happened to try to challenge police power in the late 1960s in Chicago, Fred Hampton and the Black Panthers were responsible for building what was called the Rainbow Coalition, where they organized alongside impoverished white folks, impoverished Puerto Rican communities, with the Young Lords especially, to challenge police power and to challenge all sorts of different inequities in the urban arrangement, because they realized that, you know, poverty really linked their fates together in important ways. So class is certainly important now, and class has been important for a long time. But there's an embedded reality as well, which is that, being wealthy or being middle class is not necessarily going to save you.
Oh, no. So let me jump in. I'm not saying it's going to save you. I mean, we got to talk about is Skip Gates. Henry Louis Gates, what happened to him. I'm not saying that if you're a wealthy or upper middle class African Americans that you may not face some of the same issues, but I'm talking strictly geographically.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, and in terms of that, the geography of the geography of America, in a lot of ways does determine the level of police encounter, police engagement, police interaction, and police repression that you'll face. But I will say, I mean, the point that you raise about Skip Gates is actually really instructive, I guess, in that sense, because, Skip Gates does live in this, in this upper class, mostly white enclave. And even there in that geographic space is where he, gets challenged by a police officer for trying to, enter his own home. And, because you know, we're usually, and especially for people who are middle class and upper class, you know, we're not, you know, like people who live in that economic bracket or those economic brackets have a lot of mobility across different spaces. And so, you know, when you're in your car and so on and so forth, you know, you're exposed, you know, if you're someone who's phenotypically Black, you know, or Black in appearance, you know, you are exposed to a greater likelihood of being, you know, stopped for driving while Black or walking while Black and so on and so forth. So without question, your point is right that, you know, that class and segregation and geography are really, really important determinants in terms of the likelihood that someone will face a repressive police apparatus. And you're certainly correct that, you know, for people who live in areas of concentrated and racialized poverty, in a lot of ways, they do live in a police state, in a way that people who live in the suburbs, even if they're Black, do not. So, yeah, I mean, I think that there is, I think that the ways in which class and geography are, you know, they enhance this racialized police project in really crucial ways.
And the big question is, how do we protect the people in these predominantly Black poverty neighborhoods without them feeling like they're in a police state, but there is a need for their protection?
Right. I mean, and that becomes part of this larger reimagining of how we, you know, of how public investment works. You know, I mean, that, you know, when we're looking at a city like Chicago, I mean, this is I don't know if people fully appreciate just how much money cities spend on their police forces. I mean, so a city like Chicago, which is constantly doing things like closing schools, closing mental health clinics, closing job training centers, it also spends over $1.5 billion, that's billion with a B, every single year to fund its police force. And when we think about what that money could be spent on to better the conditions and better the opportunities for people who live in those communities, I mean, it just doesn't compute why we would spend that kind of money on the police force when it would be a much simpler and much more humane system if we were investing that $1.5 billion or even a portion of that $1.5 billion, even half of that $1.5 billion into structures that would improve the conditions for members of the community in ways that would be constructive, in ways that would be affirming, in ways that would actually enhance the quality of life for everyone who lives, not just in those communities, but for people, you know, for people throughout the metropolitan area. So I think in a lot of ways, the question to how do we protect people who are living in these communities, and especially in a city like Chicago, facing oftentimes real fears of and realities of violence, I think that that entails a real reimagining of the ways in which we prioritize spending of our collective money.
Well, this has been an incredible conversation. Simon Baltel, author of Occupy Territory, Policing Black Chicago from Red Summer to Black Power. Thanks for being a guest on KAZI Book Review.
Thank you so much, Hopton. I appreciate you, Matt.
Thanks for listening to this podcast edition of KAZI Book Review. Be sure to like my Facebook page entitled KAZI Book Review, and my Twitter handle is @KAZIBooks. And my Instagram handle is KAZI_book_review. Have a great day.